Okay. Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the things. Amen. Okay, without any further ado, please make sure if you did turn your cell phone on while you're out there at the break, turn it off. And tonight our 40-minute speaker is better known as El Jefe, Fernando M.
Nice. All right. Hi, everybody. My name is Fernando, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome the two newcomers that identify themselves and the couple of Al-Anons that we have here. I don't know whether you know or not. I heard recently that even the Pope is going to Al-Anon. He has been severely affected by Mel Gibson's drinking. And I'd like to welcome... Betty was worried about the meeting having attendance and... with a gentleman here running around telling there are naked girls at this meeting, I'm sure it'll be packed by next week. anyway, I'm glad to be here. I just came down the freeway from Tustin, and I'm here to share with you a little bit of my story. And my story begins on May 9th, 1993. May 9th, 1993 happens to be Mother's Day. It was a Sunday. I happened to be in the city of Santa Rosa, which is about an hour north of San Francisco. It was Mother's Day. It was beautiful. I was on a public park, on a park bench, which at the time was my address. And I don't know, I didn't pick the day, but on this particular day around 10:30 in the morning, there were people playing in the park. It was Mother's Day. There were dogs running around. There were frisbee flying around. There was people playing guitar. And seemingly to me, everybody was happy except for me. And I had been in this desperate state and in this alcoholic comatose type of a depression, type of a long-going spree. But for a moment, around 10:30 that morning, I was able to see myself. I saw myself exactly the way I was on that particular day, on that particular moment. I was able to see myself as an alcoholic. And I need to tell you that for 20 years, I've been running away from that image and from that label and from that understanding that I was an alcoholic, because I knew what an alcoholic was. My stepfather was an alcoholic. I knew an alcoholic as someone who passed out in the front yard of the house on the lawn, and a huge German shepherd comes over and lick him on the face and try to wake him up. And I didn't want to be that person. I hated that image, because I had all this stuff in me and I couldn't express myself. I had these weird feelings coming out of me, and I had no tool to deal with it. But on this day, I was able to see that I need divine intervention in my life, but I couldn't go to God because I didn't have a God in my life. Not that I did not know about God. As a matter of fact, I know quite a bit about God. I was raised by Jesuits. And if you don't know, Jesuits are the kind of people that have God everywhere. They got God on the roof. They got God on the walls. Quite often they wear like a bell buckle. They speak God's name in 8 languages minimum. And so I've got to understand that knowing about God and having a relationship with God is 2 different things. But I'm an alcoholic. I can't go to God, so I went to a psychic instead. Because earlier, a few days earlier, there was a seed planted. I saw a classified ad, and there was a psychic that told me that for $15, she was going to give me the answers to all my problems. And she refunded $10 of my money. Because she told me I needed it. She told me I need to take all the money I have, including the $10 she gave back to me, and get a ticket from the Greyhound bus, and get on the bus, and come back to Southern California. And I need to tell you that on May 9th, 1993, everything I own in this world was in this little black plastic bag. I didn't have a car, I didn't have a place to go, I didn't have a job, I didn't have any money, I didn't have any friends, I didn't have a girlfriend, I didn't have anything. And I got on this bus. And I have burned all my bridges. And I wonder what I'm going to do next. I have no clue of what to go forward, how to take the step forward. But I had just remembered that there was this one person that I haven't met for quite a while. And maybe he was going to give me a little bit of time. And I took a dime and I put in a payphone and I called him. And this is how God worked in my life on that day. Within 10 minutes after arriving in the city of Santa Ana, I met up with this person. He gave me food to eat. He gave me a place to stay. He gave me a job. And he ordered me to go to AA. And I arrived on May 11, 1993, which is my sobriety date, into this club called Santa Ana Alano Club. And I walked in the room, and trust me, I was not impressed. As soon as I sat on the couch, I knew I hit bottom, literally. I mean, this place is not fancy like this. They have furniture, but it looked like it's been donated by the Salvation Army from the thrift store that they couldn't sell it, you know. And this was a state that I was in. It took me about 2 weeks to finally realize that the place looked really familiar. You know, you had that feeling of deja vu. And finally, about 2 weeks later, I realized that, wow, I spent 80 hours doing community service at that club. But at that time, I was not an alcoholic. I was court ordered, and I was a shoplifter, which in my mind was at least 4 levels above an alcoholic, you know. So I hide in the back in the coffee bar and did my thing and booked out of there and never attend a single meeting. And so I am one of those people that firmly believe that you could be in the house of recovery and not receive any recovery. And very soon I realized that the place I was going to get a bed and go to stay that night was this thing called recovery home. And I have no idea what the hell that was, you know. So I figured, okay, you know, Fernando's always been really impressed with Fernando's ability and intellect to solve his own problem. I figured, I'll give myself 30 days, R&R, you know. And within 30 days, I'll get myself together enough that I would be able to buy an alcoholic car. And if you don't know what an alcoholic car is something that if you need to get into a driver's seat, you got to crawl in from the passenger side, right? You know, it's got more Bondo than paint and everything else is holed up by duct tape. And when you go buy this car, the only thing the person selling the car will tell you is that it runs, you know. Doesn't want to tell you about that it needs a quart of oil every, you know, hour on the hour, you know. And it's kind of the kind of car that if it dies on the middle of the street, you just leave it there, you know. You don't even push it to the side, you know. So I figure, you know, I've been through several of these cars, you know, that in 30 days, $500, I can get one of those and I'll be out of there, you know. And I end up staying for over a year at this place. And I'm not going to talk too much, but I need to tell you this. It was that experience that I have at this recovery home. And I first experienced this thing called relapse. Never heard of it, you know, because I've always been able to stop drinking 3 times in 1 day. So, you know, never heard such a thing about, you know, staying stop. I didn't know that was my problem. So it's like every other place. Sooner or later, this one guy went out, you know, and as our book says, emerge remorse, pounding on the door, crying, begging for forgiveness, want us to take him back. By then I learned, you know, been to like 3 meetings, this thing called group conscience, you know. We hold hands, we pray about it, we talked about it, and we came to the decision, all 4 of us, that every alcoholic deserves a second chance, and we need to welcome him back like a brother. So we welcome him with open arms, you know, hugged and everything. And I need to tell you that when he went out, he took the huge color TV at that time, 25-inch, right? Huge, you know. And so welcome him back. And no sooner he got back that night, he took the black and white TV out that very night. And he's gone, you know. So the next day the house manager came by and tried to put a strap on everything, you know. The payphone got a strap, the refrigerator had a strap, microwave had a strap, and if you didn't move around fast enough, you got a strap too, you know. So it was like very interesting behavior that I have observed with alcoholics, okay? They take stuff, you know. And so it was in this kind of environment, and as I mentioned earlier, I start showing up because, you know, these places have really crazy rules, you know, really ridiculous. A lot, mandatory 4 meetings a week. Like, God, you know, that's like ridiculous, you know. And don't you know I don't have a car, right? You know, on top of everything else. And I find out, and I want to warn the couple of newcomers here, that if you come to meetings, please, whatever you do, do not ask for a ride from any of these people here. Because there's this unspoken code that if you ask for a ride, it gives them permission to talk forever and keep you hostage in the car. You know, I live about 10 minutes from the club, and it took 45 minutes to take me home, you know. They got to stop at Ralph's, you know, for some ice cream, you know, like, I got curfew, don't you know that? Oh, we'll be there, don't worry about it. I'm your sponsor, you know. I'll talk to the house manager, don't worry about it, you know. It was crazy. I have never met people that talk so compulsively, you know. And it's all about themselves, you know. Like, I'm waiting for a chance. I mean, don't you know I came from a park bench, you know. Can I say something, you know? I mean, excuse me, I have an opinion too, you know. And so, this was strange, you know, this is really strange. And by now, you kind of realize that, yeah, Fernando's talking about Southern California, Northern California. He speaks kind of funny. I don't know where he's from. And I need to tell you by now that I'm really from China. I was born in a place called Macau, which is about 30 miles from Hong Kong, and the only thing I can assure you that I'm not 100% Chinese, you know. Even though I speak Chinese fluently, and this is a fact that I'm aware of, that my mother gave me up for adoption when I was about 6 months old, walked down the steps of a convent, and gave me away to the nuns. And I grew up in this kind of a place, and there was a doorman, and he was Chinese, and he took me in, and it was crazy, you know. It was all right. I felt loved, and I was very poor. We live in places that did not have running water nor electricity, but I could say I had a good childhood and was happy, and everything was fine until I turned about 11. When I was about 11, I learned very quickly that I couldn't be horny and Catholic all at the same time, you know. So they sent me to confession, you know, and I told the priest, yes, I have been sexually active, and someday I would like to have a partner. and they sent me back the next week, and same sin, you know. Down to singular now, you know, just the same thing, you know, like whatever I told you last week, same thing, you know. And I began to have problem with this religion because growing up it was like, God, does God really don't get things right? I mean, how hard is it? I don't get to pick my parents, you know. Can't you pick like 2 Chinese people or 2 Portuguese people? Why do you have to pick 1 Chinese and 1 Portuguese? And by the way, that's my background. And 50 years ago, my mother was known to be not a very nice lady because she messed around with foreigners, you know. And people would actually come right up to me and says, you're a half-breed, and tell me about the shame that my mother has brought upon me. And I always felt different growing up, you know, because I knew I wasn't Chinese and I wasn't Portuguese. I felt like a giraffe in a herd of horses. I look like a horse, I run like a horse, but I ain't a horse. My neck is way too long, sticking out, you know. And I just feel very uncomfortable. And but I learned English, and then about 11, around that time, they I was, you know, too big to be hanging around in the girls' convent school, so which is okay. They sent me to a boys' school, and the problem became was that the boys' school was all Chinese curriculum, and the girls' school was all English curriculum. And I knew how to speak Chinese, but I did not know how to read nor write. And I need to tell you, that's where some of Fernando's problem come in. My intellect was so impressive to me that I knew that if I put my mind on anything, I can conquer it. So I spent 18 months, and during the 18 months, I memorized a complete dictionary, and I became fluent in Chinese, both in writing and speaking and reading. And if you don't know, Chinese does not have an alphabet. It's all by pictures. And so I would write everything 100 times. And what I'm trying to impress upon you is that I have, like in Bill's story, realized that I have power. That things will come up in my life that if I put my mind into it, I can overcome it. And then when I was about 14, one day these priests came up and said, "Would you like to go to America?" There seems to be a couple in Long Beach, he's American and she's Chinese, would like to adopt you. And I was like, wow, okay. So my first part of my life is like all of a twist, but now it's all happy ending. And by then, I have heard of America. I knew about Hollywood, you know. I knew about California Beach, you know, and more than anything else, I knew there was a mysterious creature not to be found in all of China, and it's called a blonde, you know, because all the girls in China have dark hair, so I was looking forward to come up, you know, close and personal, and meet face to face with a blonde, you know, so. Wait a little while. When I was 16, I arrived there and I landed in Long Beach, and that's when I realized that the home that I was going to go into was a severe alcoholic home, and there was all kinds of stuff, and I bore the pain and the suffering for about 3 years. At 19, one day it just got so bad, I just left. And I swear that I will never go back ever again, and I kept my promise for 30 years. At the age of 19, I met one of these blonde people, start introducing with, you know, this is early 70s, to this concept called cool. Everything is cool, you know. Took me to a concert by a band from San Francisco called The Tubes, and the number one song was White Punks on Dope, you know. And I found my people, you know. And I've always said that being, you know, half Chinese, half Portuguese, that the Portuguese side of me drank all the wine, and the Chinese side did all the opium, you know. So I hang with these people, and I, trust me, I had fun. I mean, I had great times. I've been to the best parties in the world, in very little bathrooms, you know. Hold about 25 people, you know. And then that's like, also like in Bill's story, which I identify, that if you knock on the door and they actually open the door and invite you in, then you know Fernando has arrived, you know. Because like, it's kind of crowded in there, you know. So I went through this process, and believe me, you know, I don't want to speak bad about alcohol, because alcohol was the thing that I was looking for. You know, from age 0 to 19, I was uncomfortable within my own skin, and then I found sudden comfort. Oh, man, that was like... And then it begins this journey of, I don't remember, you know. I had tickets, I still do, for the very first Grand Prix of Long Beach. I knew I was there, but I don't remember, okay? I know I went to quite a few cow jam concerts, you know, in Anaheim and different places, but I don't remember, you know? So it goes through this journey, and trust me, I have never seen myself as anybody with problem. And the reason being is that I surrounded myself with people that, for example, my roommate, his nickname is Blackout, so I don't need to explain to you. And the reason he got his nickname was that we got a call from the Costa Mesa PD, says, there's a guy pass out on the drive through at the Jack in the Box, and his wallet has your name and address and phone number. He belongs there? Oh, yeah, that's Blackout. Yeah, come on, take him home, you know. So, and my other roommate, his name is Bandit, and the reason he got that name was because he robbed the local liquor store without a mask, at which he goes 3 times a week, you know. And so, that was Bandit, you know. And then this other guy that eventually also moved in with us, and his name was Torch, you know. He had a minor accident with some kind of a fire thing, you know, and spilled something, and the couch got on fire, and I come home from work, and the fire department was there hosing the living room down, you know. And so when you live with these type of people, you're definitely not an alcoholic, you know. I'm still the one functioning, you know. And all of us was trying to be the best friend of this girl that we hang out with. She had a horrible car accident, got a lot of burns in her body, and we call her Toast, you know. And these are real people. Trust me, these are real people. And the reason we try to be her best friend, because she got a couple $1 million of settlement, and we're just trying to help her spend it, you know. So, we had fun, you know, we had fun. We went do things, meet people, has long conversations, starting from 6 a.m. until the next morning, you know. And my place was always the place to come, you know, because we always have refreshments of all kinds, all the time. And the other thing, too, that I do not want to impress upon you that I did not hear of, Alcoholics Anonymous. I did, in my travels, have heard of it. Except that my concept of AA was really unique, you know, because I thought that Alcoholics Anonymous was like the Bermuda Triangle of missing people. You know, and I want to explain to you is that, you know, you always have a good friend named John, right? John's always good for a 12-pack or something, right? And one day you heard that John went to AA and nobody had ever seen John ever again. John is not hanging out in the front porch, you know. John's telephone doesn't work anymore, you know. Have you seen John? No, we haven't seen him, you know. I even looked up the sheriff department's website and he's not listed either, you know. Because he's always there, you know. And so... It's like, I don't want to go to AA because, you know, you just like, nobody know where you go, you know. So, that wasn't my plan, you know. My plan was to, you know, have life go on and be happy and just enjoy and experiment. And the thing was this. Throughout the whole point is that finally now I'm coming look a point was that the thing that was important to me are the music. Music such as Comfortably Numbed, you know, by Pink Floyd. Such as I Want to Be Sedated by the Ramones, you know. I really identify with those deep lyrics, you know. Or Have a Beer with Fear, you know. Wow, okay, you know. And of course, not the one that by Dead Kennedys, known as Too Drunk to F. and so it was like life, and I really did not want it to end. I really did not want it to end until I hit this wall in 1993, and I ran out of options. And I'm a quick learner, you know. I told you I end up in this club. And, you know, I don't know. Let me tell you, and I'm sure you know about that. There are some really nosy people in these rooms, you know. And all they do all day is mind your business, you know. And they ask you really personal questions like, who's your sponsor? You know, hey, that's personal, you know? Like, and then like something really personal, like what step are you on? It's none of your business, you know? But then I learned quickly that if you tell people that you have a sponsor, guess what? They leave you alone, right? So I saw an old guy, and I figured, okay, I can always outrun that guy. So I call him, start to refer to him as my sponsor. And I need to tell you this. I have this problem by now when I first arrived. You know, and a lot of us didn't know that when you first come to program, most of us have this problem with the three T's, you know, which is tickets, taxes, and teeth, you know. And my one of my problems was taxes, you know. I got this, you know, knock on my door one day, and it was the IRS, and they were looking for emergency donation, you know. And I'm going like, hey, you know. So I never dealt with these people, because in my mind was this, oh my God, I owe them a lot of money. And, you know, my only measure of reality is that how I deal with people out there, meaning that if I borrow $100 from you, you would not want me to pay you $1 a week for the next 100 week, right? You want $125 right now, you know? And so I thought that's how the IRS operate, you know? They would want all their money plus whatever on top of that, and they want it all in a lump sum right there. So I was really... didn't have any clue. So I asked this old guy, who I call my sponsor, what should I do? And he told me the stupidest thing I've ever heard from a human being. He said, call the IRS. I said, you got to be kidding. Didn't you know I've been trying to fly underneath the radar for the last 8 years? You want me to actually report myself? You got to be crazy. So I waited around 2 weeks, trying to find other options, and I didn't have anything better. So I have no other choice. I said, okay, you know, maybe he's old, but maybe they do it in before World War II. Let me try it, you know. So I called, and this lady on the other end was excited. She said, oh, Fernando, oh, we're so happy that you call. And I'm like, oh, can anything else I can do for you? And so she told me that I could pay them $25 a week. And all I had to do is write a check. And my mind immediately started running. Because I need to tell you, it's really not my fault. You know, I went to the bank, opened a checking account with $100, and they gave me 500 checks, you know. So I did not know. I mean, the way I operate is that if you want a check, let me give you three. I don't want you to be coming back and forth bothering me, okay? Just do whatever you want to. Here's three of them, you know. And so I said, okay, you want a check? Phew, you will get a check. But obviously, these people, they dealt with people like us, you know. And because she add on, she says, if any of these checks bounce, and I understand what she meant, then we'll come after you and get all our money. You know, I thought, no, that's my money. She said, no, it's our money. So, and I need to tell you, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous for me is this. For 7.5 years, every month, without any kind of excuse or any reason for not doing it, I was able to put a little check into an envelope and send it to the IRS. And the reason it's so impressive in me is this, is that I am the kind of alcoholic that is a great 100 yards dash kind of a person. I can do anything for 1 hour, you know. But I am definitely not a marathon runner, you know. And anything that involves days, months, that ain't me, you know. You know, because as my wife doesn't like to hear, is that, you know, even a weekend is a long relationship, right? You know, so, you know, I like to just hit and go, you know. And so I was able to keep this up month after month after month for 7.5 years. And after that 7.5 years, the IRS sent me a letter and says, we're good with each other. And this is what I want to tell you. The people that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous, these noisy, busybody, nosy people that I hated at the very beginning, and somehow, little by little, without my invitation, kicked down the door to my heart, barged in and saved my life. Saved my life. I had about 30 days sobriety, And I met this girl, and I went to a meeting, and I went to the bathroom, and I came back, I was elected GSR. You know how they do it, right? Like, me? What happened? You know, like, you know? And I didn't even know what GSR is, you know? And the only thing I could think is that I'm a child of the 60s. GSR was probably group sex representative, you know? Because as the child of the 60s, you all know sex was a group activity in those days, right? You know, so I didn't know what it was, you know? And they said, you need to go someplace once a month. And my first excuse, I didn't have a car, you know? And they said, don't worry. This lady came up, she says to me, she said, you know, I go there too once a month. If you can get there, I make sure you get a ride home. And true to her word, she gave me a ride home every month. And we begin to know each other, and we begin to start talking. And one day, in the course of a normal conversation, I just says, what do you do for a living? That's usually my favorite question. She said, I don't work. I said, if you don't work, this is a pretty nice car. How do you pay for this? She says, I'm on SSI. And I didn't know anything about SSI except that I thought it was for old people. And I said, you're kind of young for this SSI thing. She chose to reveal to me at that time was that she was HIV positive and that she had AIDS. And that really impacted me. It's not so much, I mean, I know I have a problem with people leaving me. All my life, people left me. You know, my real parents left me. These priests left me. This couple in Long Beach, they left me. Deep down within myself, Fernando, know without a doubt that I am unlovable. And if you get close enough to me, you will leave me. So once again, I get close to somebody and she was dying. And she will leave me. And I had a lot of problem with that. And I knew what I would normally do was to get up and run. But I had different second thoughts now. I have a little bit of sobriety. So I asked this old guy again. I said, what should I do? I couldn't deal with this. I don't know how to process this. And he says, do the right thing. I said, it's easy for you. I don't know what the right thing is. So you will find out what the right thing is. And about a week of just thinking about this, driving myself crazy, finally I realized what the right thing was. The right thing was for me to be her friend. She was my friend. The right thing is that if whatever happened, I embraced that moment of knowing her, embraced that friendship of knowing her, and just treasure the time that we had together. And I walked on into this path of recovery. And I'm so happy to announce to you that she's still alive today. And I met this other person that the fact that I didn't have a car gave me a ride to a meeting for over 365 days and never missed a day. These are my miracles. It's very, very ordinary, but it was consistent. It was so strong that I could not even deny it. I knew there was something working in my life that I have no part in it. And then when I was 5 years sober, I had a business, started recording all kinds of meetings and stuff. And when I was 10 years sober, I finally was able to get a house. And then about 6 or 7 years ago, a friend of mine died, and he was a wonderful speaker, speak all over the world. And I thought I knew him. He was also living in Tustin. We met periodically in restaurants. One of our favorite restaurants for all alcoholics is a place called Me, you know. And I love the name, you know. Yeah, I may not be much, you know, but I think about myself all the time. and he died, you know. And I showed up at the memorial, and they had a podium, and they had a piece of paper up front. And I didn't know what it was. I walked up there and looked at it, and it looked like a diploma, and so I asked the widow, I said, what the heck is that? And she told me that, he didn't know, he went back to law school when he was 60 years old. And he died when he was 67. It took him 7 years. He finally got the diploma. He graduated from law school. Somebody doing their own thing without Fernando in their mind, and the result impacted me forever. Because I looked at that and I go, I don't think he's going to be the Johnny Cochran of law, you know. He's 60 years old and he still wants to go back to school. It must be something for the inside. And I reflect upon that, and for, on that day, I finally see something about Fernando that I was not okay with. Because all these years, I've told people, I've written on the application, whenever they ask that personal question, which they have no business to ask, and they would say, what kind of education do you have? And I always claim, 2 years of college. What do you mean? But I have to be honest, I did not have 2 years of college. I have 2 years of ping pong in college, but I didn't have 2 years of college. So on that day, I finally see myself that Fernando was a college dropout. And I knew that that was something I have to do for myself. So I asked my wife, very supportive, good Al-Anon, make sure you get one too. Supported me, says, do what you have to. So I went back to school, and in 2003, I got my little AA degree. And I need to tell you that my transcript for the two-year degree starts from 1973 to 2003. It took me 30 years to get this two-year degree. And only people in AA understand that I'm not stupid, I'm just distracted. And so, it started this fire within me, you know, and I got the taste of learning, and I wanted to continue. And I once again asked her, and I says, you know, I want to do more. She said, go right ahead. And so I went to Cal State Fullerton, and in 2006, I graduated at the age of 50 years old as the most outstanding graduating senior of all of Cal State Fullerton. You know, and I was like, wow, I can't believe, you know, not so long ago, you know, I was this person that did not even like himself, that did not have any earthly possession, that the address was a park bench, and now they put my picture on a jumbotron and says, I am somebody. And all because I walked through this path of recovery. And I did well in Cal State Fullerton. And I did so well, they gave me a scholarship to go to UCLA for further studies. And I graduated from UCLA last June. And I had these grand plans. I had these plans that I was going to, you know, work with white people with relationship problem, you know. And because charge $300 an hour or something like that, you know. And so that was what I was wanting. I was like, I want to, you know, like, do things. But my higher power has a different plan. That didn't work out at all. It failed so miserably that I was really upset about it. And I just happened to be asked to substitute for a class. And I found my calling. And today, I am a drug and alcohol counselor, teaching other people that we do drug and alcohol counseling. So I work with alcoholics and addicts. And just recently, just in case I forget who I work with, I was subpoenaed to go to court for a parole hearing for one of my students. That did not happen at Cal State Fullerton. So this is my path. And now what I want you is that this is how quite often I see Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I arrive in these rooms, I thought that these rooms were like bus stations. I came in, I figured, okay, I can catch a ride from one of you guys. You know, I want a loving relationship. I want financial security. And all I have to do is put my thumb out and get a ride. And very quickly, I realized that these rooms are not bus stations. You can't get a ride in here. These rooms are gas stations because you guys only sell one thing and one thing only, something with a capital G. And the way I look at myself is that quite often it's like the book, we are powerless. And I didn't understand what that means. And so come to the idea that if I'm powerless, I could be like a car. And that means that I have a dead battery. It wouldn't run. But that's not the problem. Because I've seen other people done it. You know, when they have a dead battery, they get all these people around them, the enablers, the codependents, the Al-Anons, and they say, I just need a little push, just a little help, you know. And you know, they get very excited. They go, oh yeah, he's asking for help, let's help him. So they start pushing my car, right? And because I've seen other people done it. They jump in the car, they do something, and the car started, and they go on the merry highway. And I get my people, and they push. And I jump in there, and I couldn't get it started. And I said, maybe, I don't understand, maybe you didn't push hard enough. Maybe you didn't push far enough. Maybe you didn't push long enough. And after repeated failure of them supporting me, I still couldn't get my car started. And they look at me with those disgusted look and eyes and says, "Don't you dare ask me to help you ever again." And that's when I ran into that wall. I did not know what was happening until this old guy called my sponsor and says, "Dummy, you are bodily and mentally different from your fellows." You know, and I'm like, "What the hell are you talking about?" You know? See, those other people, they get the car started, they have standard transmission. What you have is an automatic transmission. You can push the car until the cows come home, it ain't going to start. I say, "What is this about standard transmission and automatic transmission? What are you talking about?" He says, "Because you use different fluid." I did not know that. I said, "How do you know I am an automatic, you know? Because of that liquid you pour into you with a big A on it, you know?" And I says, "Okay, if I can't get the car push start, then how do I get it started?" He said, "We got a simple program." "And what do you mean by simple program?" "It's as simple as a jumper cable, you know? So all I have to do is connect my positive and my negative and to your positive and your negative. Somehow power is going to be magically transferred from my car to your car." Wow, that sounded simple, right? But it was nearly impossible. And the reason is this. It requires me to pop open up this hood and show you the dirty, grimy, greasy, corroded engine that I have not shown anybody for a long, long time. And I believe firmly that's why we need these meetings. It is in these rooms that we find another and have these interactions so we begin to trust one another. So I can be able to be vulnerable and allow you to come into my life. It is not impossible for me to realize that I needed help. But it was impossible for me to ask for help. And the reason is this. All my life I've been trying to be self-sufficient. And I know that if I ask you for something, then I'll end up owing you something. And I never like to owe anybody that. And that's why I don't even bother my God. Only when I'm in big trouble. And my recovery today is this, is that I learned to have this conversation with my God for every little things in life. So that we could be intimate. So that we can have this relationship that I didn't have. So that we can have this transfer of ideas and feelings with one another. So that we become close. So that I can pop open up the hood and show you what's really inside Fernando. And today, I look at the group as this. It was that Alcoholics Anonymous quite often is like the banquet of life. Every one of us brings a dish. It's like a banquet. And we bring a dish and we put on this table and we share. And I need to tell you, for somebody that was so less than and so inferior on the feeling on the inside, today I honestly can say I feel comfortable in bringing something and lay it on the table and share with you. And every one of us brings something to this banquet of life and we share. And we share one another. And we share our thoughts, and we share our feelings, and most important, we share our pain. It is in these rooms we find the mirror that so I can use you to reflect upon me so I can see myself. Because I've been so blind. I've been so blind. I have eyes, but I can't see. I have a heart, but I couldn't feel. I have a brain. And it didn't do me any good. Because alcoholism is the disease that regardless of how ill I am at the doorstep of hell, and I still think that I'm on the highway of life. It is true, the people in this room that pull my hand and held me tight and say, come along, we're going to trudge on this road to happy destiny. And I need to close today with this, which is what I always close with. I see the program of Alcoholics Anonymous like this. I was born like a candle lit in life, and somewhere along life, my light went out because a wind blew, and I was cold and I was dark until I arrived in these rooms, and I saw that every one of you was like a candle that was lit. And one of you came up to me and says that if I allow myself to get close to you and for you to get close to me, that's how we candles light each other. I was fortunate to get close to one of you, and once again, I was lit. But I was warned not to be stagnant, that I need to go out in the dark and search other candles in the dark and let them know that if they can get close enough to me and I can get close enough to them, that's how we candles light each other. And the dream for me is this, that I light enough candles and they in turn light enough candles that our flames together will be as bright as daylight. Thank you for having me.